listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The LA Zoo has been closed since March, but that changes today. Once again, you can take your kids to see the lions and tigers and bears, oh my, but there are a few behind-the-scenes animals that you won't see. That's Cricket. He's an Indian white-eye, a yellowish-green songbird the size of a sparrow. Cricket was trafficked from Vietnam in 2019. A wildlife smuggler tried to sneak him into the country illegally to sell for his beautiful song. Cricket wound up being confiscated with a group of 20 other birds at LAX. Now, the LA Zoo often gets the call when animals are discovered at the airport or at the port of LA.
We've had everything from cobras inside Pringle cans to birds wrapped in socks attached to people's legs to even primates.
Mike Maxey keeps an eye on Cricket and other trafficked birds as the curator of the LA Zoo's Avian Conservation Center. He says there's big money in wildlife trafficking. It's also a huge risk. His colleague, LA Zoo Conservation Director Jake Owens, points out trafficked animals can bring disease with them, like the one causing the current pandemic.
A bird that's in the wild in a forest that's, you know, that's not degraded, where they can live their normal lives, isn't that big of a risk for a disease, right? It's when we're tearing down the forests, where we're degrading them, we're putting them in these small areas because that's the only habitat that's left, or we're catching them, putting them in cages, stacking them up in bushmeat markets or wildlife markets to sell them for food or for songbird trade. That's when the risk comes in.
Reporter Jesse Hardman recently stopped by the LA Zoo to chat with staff about how their work is directly related to the novel coronavirus, the one that we're all dealing with right now, and what they're doing to try and make sure the next COVID-19 never happens. And Jesse joins me right now. Hey there.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
I'm all right. So of all the places to go to better understand the pandemic that's taken over pretty much all our lives, what made you go to the zoo?
Well, I felt like the human narrative of COVID-19, you know, all the things we're worried about every day, took over pretty quickly. But the root of this story is wildlife and conservation. Everybody knows now a market in Wuhan, China, is where this virus jumped from an animal, probably a bat, to humans. Jake Owens is the first ever conservation director at the LA Zoo, and he used to work in China on wildlife protection, so he seemed like a good person to chat with to get some deeper insights.
Everything that people are experiencing because of coronavirus, not going to bars, not going to school, not going to work, losing their houses, is due to wildlife trade. That's how everybody needs to start thinking about this. If we're not focused on solving that problem, we're just going to have this happen again. It's only a matter of time. And because climate change and habitat loss are increasing, the likelihood that this event happens more frequently is higher.
And Jake said the arrival of COVID-19 wasn't shocking at all to him. He's also worked on issues of wildlife poaching and trafficking in Africa, and he referred to some of the wildlife markets there as hell on earth and pandemics waiting to happen.
That sounds pretty scary, actually. Now, in the introduction, we referenced a songbird that had been trafficked from Vietnam, was confiscated over at LAX, and wound up being taken care of by the folks at the zoo. Help me connect, Jesse, the dots between that bird being trafficked and the pandemic.
Well, wildlife trafficking is big business, billions of dollars, placing it in the same realm as guns and drugs. And actually, those enterprises often overlap. Wildlife trafficking includes everything from the illicit ivory trade that leads to the slaughtering of elephants and rhinos, which people are generally more familiar with, to somebody trying to get that small Indian white-eyed bird, Cricket, through LAX. And Cricket, by the way, is an example of a really lucrative illegal songbird market. People pay thousands of dollars to acquire similar male songbirds, and they bring them to clandestine competitions where the loudest bird or the one with the prettiest song can win money. But the fate of Cricket can be tied back to our current predicament in a few ways. One, birds can be carriers of zoonotic diseases, which can impact humans and local animal species if they're unleashed. Here's the zoo's bird specialist, Mike Maxey, again.
Well, let's see. We've had the bird flu. You got West Nile virus. You got H1N1. All those can have some kind of connection with birds. Usually you have something in between, like a mosquito, that helps transmit that. But just recently here in Southern California, we had an outbreak of Newcastle's disease, which created a quarantine for all chickens, turkeys, peacocks, anything like that, because of the potential of not really affecting humans, but devastating the poultry industry. And those birds that created this Newcastle's epidemic more than likely were illegally imported from Mexico. And that created havoc for 18 months where millions of chickens, mostly backyard chickens, had to be euthanized to prevent the spread of the disease. So birds are definitely a vector for serious disease.
The second way to tie the small traffic birds back to our current pandemic situation is that its displacement often goes hand in hand with habitat destruction. Animals are losing their homes due to deforestation and degradation, and that puts them in situations that are harmful to them and, by extension, us. The zoo staff talked about rare bird species disappearing entirely from places like islands in the Philippines, creating an effect they call the silent forest.
What, Jesse, can the LA Zoo do, though, to counter things like this habitat destruction and trafficking that you speak of?
That's a great question, Steve. Most people tend to think of a zoo as an entertainment center or like a classroom for people to learn about wildlife, which is great, but the entertainment cost also generates revenue. And depending on what a zoo's goals are, that and other sources of money like private donations and grants can go towards all sorts of wildlife-related goals. So the more money the zoo raises, the more it can provide trafficked animals with a quarantine space where they can go through rehabilitation, breeding programs, and for some, an eventual reintroduction to the wild. But zoos aren't just arcs for species. They can also extend their influence outwards, too. Many countries that see higher levels of wildlife trafficking don't have the resources to do much about it. Jake Owens mentioned a partnership the LA Zoo has with the Wildlife Trust of India, a conservation nonprofit, and the LA Zoo provided funds for research of the local gharial population, a kind of endangered fish-eating river crocodile.
This year, the biologists weren't able to go out because of COVID, and they had a complete lockdown in India. So they called the farmers and the fishermen who are able to go out, and they were able to relocate three nests for, I think, a total of 94 hatchlings that successfully hatched out.
Jesse, any insight on how optimistic the staff over at the zoo are about preventing future zoonotic diseases? I suspect are ones that go from animal to animal or from animal to human, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from getting out into the world, causing these kinds of pandemics.
You won't be surprised when I tell you it's complicated. The current pandemic has put a spotlight on animal trafficking, but there's a fear that the main solution will just be going after traffickers themselves, trying to arrest them, and increasing the fines for these crimes, which tend to be low. That might be the high-profile approach, but it won't solve the root of the problem, according to the zoo's conservation staff. They say ultimately, wildlife trafficking and the health of the world's human population, it all comes down to global poverty. This is Jake Owens again. He's the zoo's conservation director.
This is the only thing that some people have to do for their livelihoods, going out and catching these animals. That's a root issue that we, as conservation biologists and as just cultures and society and governments, have totally not addressed, is that root problem. And until we do, there's never going to be a solution, and we just wait 10 years for the next COVID to happen.
I don't know if we're ready to go through this again. Jesse Hardman, thanks for stopping by, for sharing this story.
Thanks so much, Steve. My pleasure.
And by the way, yeah, the LA Zoo is reopening today, but it is limiting attendance. So you can support their work, visit the animals without the usual big crowds. And they're taking reservations to get into the zoo on their website starting right now.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Restaurants have been hit hard by the pandemic. Many of them across LA have closed permanently. Others have capitalized on takeout and alfresco dining, barely managing to stay afloat, though. Since the pandemic shutdown went into effect back in mid-March, folks in the service industry have been forced to grapple with so many insecurities. Whether they would get federal or state assistance, whether their restaurant would be able to remain open, whether, if they were able to remain open, the customers would even come through their doors. A lot of what-ifs, obviously. Lynn Ta has lived through both sides of that coin, by the way. Her Silver Lake breakfast all-day restaurant called All Day Baby has prevailed. But her Koreatown spot, Here's Looking at You, recently announced that they were closing, possibly even for good. And she's here now to tell us about her experience in the restaurant industry during a pandemic. Lynn, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on, Steve.
You just closed Here's Looking at You. That must have been excruciatingly difficult, given that you only opened it a few years ago, right? And much beloved Jonathan Gold reviewed it. Tell us about how you got here to closing it and whether it's for good.
Oh, it was heartbreaking to do that. It was a difficult decision. I mean, we closed immediately when we were mandated to close on March 15th, and that was our last night of service. After receiving the PPP loan, we opted to, of course, rehire our team, reopened at the end of May for takeout and delivery. And the prediction that I had as far as how that restaurant would sort of pivot to takeout and delivery was slightly bleak. And unfortunately, what I projected came true, which was it was just so slow. The food is still good. The food was served in takeout containers, but it's just, and people do love that restaurant, but no one was actually coming. And so it forced me to think about, was it the location? Was it because it's a destination restaurant and people are obviously being told to stay home and not travel far, even for takeout? So unfortunately, the money and the economics just didn't make sense, and we had to choose to close on July 12th, and it is looking like forever.
I'm so sorry. I know it's hard, and you know, I guess bright side is that All Day Baby is still going, right? It's a newer place. Why did you decide to keep that one open, and how have you adapted in that space since the pandemic began?
Well, All Day Baby, you know, it also closed at the time of the mandated closure on March 15th. We again reopened with the PPP loan at the end of May. And the bright side to that was that people were still coming to All Day Baby. And, you know, maybe it's because it's Silver Lake and that neighborhood, I don't know what you call needing a biscuit sandwich, that's $13. But yes, people were still coming to the restaurant to sort of order our food. It's not a lot of people, and it's not enough money to sustain, you know, premium Silver Lake rent and the capacity to which that we signed our lease for. But we decided that we would downsize the team, the newly rehired team with the PPP loan. We're down to 6 hourly employees. So we're working on a very small skeleton model, pushing out this takeout and delivery. And so far it's doing okay. And the loyalty has been absolutely the best dish served during the pandemic. I mean, it's absolutely amazing to see guests that come weekly. Some people come daily. It's been pretty extraordinary to see.
I think what's so halting, I think, about the whole situation is the fact that you just don't know. And that eventually, I mean, there's this thing that just sort of lurks there. It's like, at some point, we'll be able to get back out. At some point, we'll be able to take off our masks. At some point, life will get back to some semblance of normalcy. But we just don't know. Given what we've been dealing with and how restaurants and so many other businesses have had to reimagine what they do in this way of life that we're in, you know, do you think that you're going to be able to stick it through no matter what? I mean, what are you doing to innovate? What are you doing to change things up a little bit to make sure that you can?
I mean, the truth is I, you're right. I don't know if I'm going to be able to sustain these times because we don't know how long it's going to be. So it's a matter of, can I still continue to pay this $1,800 bill monthly to the LADWP? You know, is my landlord willing to, you know, abate some of my $13,000 rent? You know, these are all the things that will be the make or break bullet points that where we will see which restaurants are going to make it and which restaurants are not going to make it. For me, you know, what I can control, because those are some of the uncontrollables, what I can control is our product. What I can control is making something compelling enough to drive people to still join us at the restaurant. We need to generate sales, you know, so if every day I, you know, there seems to be some sort of pattern to the number of guests enjoying us on a Thursday, for example, which is kind of slow, you know, what else can I do and implement to generate extra money? So, for example, we started working with a nonprofit called El Nido, where people would essentially donate to El Nido family centers, and that money would get sort of infiltrated into the restaurant. The restaurant itself would get paid to make meals and deliver to this housing community down in Watts. So I've been doing this the last 2 weeks. I have another one scheduled for this Thursday. We make about 110 meals a week for adults and children. And so that's just like extra revenue we can do. I have another idea for a cocktail delivery gram. You know, back when in high school, you would send carnations as little grams with messages. I have this idea that I want to send cocktails as part of a delivery system where you can send it. I'm going to send you one, Steve, with a nice message.
What is it about the restaurant business? I mean, this is such a challenging time for so many folks. What was it that got you into the restaurant business in the first place? And why is LA such a special place for it?
I mean, it's a great question how I got myself into this predicament.
It's not a predicament, though, but it's a love for you, right? It's a love. It's not a predicament.
It's an absolute love. I love food. I love restaurants. And I think the best way for me to describe it is that it really enables me to capture a true connection with guests and through something that really is a fundamental part of being human, which is true nourishment. And if we can do that, you know, on a food level, on a human level, and communicating and all of that, it really is extraordinarily fulfilling for me. I mean, these are some really challenging times right now, but I still really love going to work. I love my staff. It's a way to, you know, generate leaders, provide inspiration, another way of doing things. Like, it doesn't have to be the same. And I do try and strive to lead in a way so that every day is a little bit different and provides more growth than the day before.
And why Los Angeles? Why open here?
At the time that I opened my first restaurant, I found that Los Angeles still needed more culinary voices. And what I love about Los Angeles restaurants is that there is a room for so many different kinds of voices. And our first restaurant was so much about celebrating the intersection of different cultures that exist in Los Angeles. It's just more fun. There's so many levels. It's not one note. There really is this message that anyone can succeed.
You think that'll continue even after the pandemic is gone?
I think that if people still have the energy and the wherewithal to try again, and I guess I'm speaking for the people maybe that might see some closures, I think absolutely. It may take some time, but we cannot let the chain restaurants take over.
Lynn Ta, owner of All Day Baby in Silver Lake and restaurateur here in Los Angeles. Lynn, thank you for your time. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Onward now with Greater LA, KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It has been hot the past couple of weeks, and if you've got access to it, chances are you've made ample use of your air conditioning. In the office, AC used to be one of those mechanical systems in a building that you probably gave very little thought to, unless, of course, it stopped working on a very hot day. But now air conditioning has become a weapon in the transmission of COVID-19. And when you talk about returning to the office or the classroom, air and access to fresh air or clean, non-recirculated air is more important than ever before. Frances Anderton covers design and architecture for KCRW, and she's with us now. Hey, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
It's so funny. I mean, you think about how hot it is and how much you need air conditioning, and I forget sometimes. I mean, I grew up in the South where if you didn't have an air conditioner, you just sweat to death. In Southern California, a lot of folks don't have air conditioning.
That's right. And if you're lucky enough, Steve, to live in a part of town where you can just have the breezes circulating around your home or your workplace, you're in somewhat of a lucky position, because what is emerging in all the studies of what causes the transmission of coronavirus is that air conditioning can be a factor. In fact, as laid out in a recent Atlantic article, there are two key mitigation strategies for countering the transmission of coronavirus via so-called virus-laden aerosols indoors, and that's through diluting the air in the room with air that comes from outside, or removing viral particles from the air with filters. Air conditioning and sort of the design of the air conditioning system has become a really important factor. You know, we hear a lot about these sort of super spreaders of the virus, and they are said to result often from a convergence of the three Vs: venue, vocalization, and ventilation. This is when you get a lot of people gathering together in an indoor venue. They might talk, they might sing, it might be a religious event, and poor ventilation is believed to intensify the transmission of those viral droplets that they're, excuse the language, kind of spewing from their mouths. So anyway, air conditioning and its design has become a big factor among building owners, building managers, designers, architects. I spoke with one architect, Rastan Zaitlian. He recently completed a new office building in Santa Monica, and he talked about how air has become such a big issue.
Any meetings in renovations or brand new buildings, the central question is, how can we create the healthiest building possible, and how can we combat this pandemic, or even, you know, future other aberrations of this pandemic or other pandemic?
How do you go about doing that, though, Frances? I mean, we can all agree that air conditioners need to ventilate the air better, but what are the ways to do that?
The ways to do it are improving the filtering and improving the circulation. And without going in too much into the minutiae of how you do it, there are certain filters that people, our building managers, are now adding to their systems, and there's rating qualities that they're aiming at. One particular person I spoke with, he's Kerry Upton. He's the chief operations officer at the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. They were already in the process of installing a new air conditioning system, and he says that now they are having to amend that system.
We anticipate in many places to both have the fans on so that we're constantly turning over and exchanging the air, but in those spaces where we can, we'll also have the windows and the doors open, which is completely inefficient, but it will increase the amount of air exchange which is necessary during this pandemic.
So that's part of what they're doing. He says they're also considering adding a UV lighting system or an ionization system that would kill bacteria, mold, and viruses. These could add substantial costs to each classroom. He knows this will increase their energy bills, but he says that until they can improve their air quality, they're not going to consider having students return to school.
I remember the days, Frances, when, you know, if the air conditioning was running, mom would say, close the door, the air conditioning's running, right? Or close the window, you know, you don't want to cool the rest of the neighborhood. And it sounds, I mean, he, you know, you talk about inefficiency, my goodness. It sounds like, by the way, it would be just cheaper to work outside.
Yes, and indeed. And in fact, certainly school districts have looked at the possibility of having some of the learning going on outside. And in assuming your building's in a part of town that has good outside air quality, try and figure out a way to be outside as much as possible. Now, the designer, Rastan Zaitlian, who we heard from earlier, again, he recently completed an office renovation, and there he made being outside or having natural ventilation a feature of the design.
The best way actually to create a healthy environment is to have fresh air coming in into the building as much as possible and creating air circulations. I mean, that's a very old passive idea, very prevalent in kind of old architectures in the Middle East, where you try to create air circulation to move the air and bring in fresh air.
Do you think, Francis, when people start going back to the office, when people start congregating back at work, do you think that, that it will change in how we do that? Will there be the open office space, or will we see more partitions, cubicles, walls, doors?
Certainly, I'm sure some spaces will be reconfigured just in the way that you've outlined. Some won't. But I guarantee you that building managers, building owners, designers are all thinking about how to make buildings healthier, is the term that's used. There was already a conversation going on in the building community about the so-called sick buildings, and air conditioning had already been part of that discussion. People knew that poor air conditioning contributed to the circulation of germs and illness. So I think that a lot of office workers are going to find that their ventilation systems might be somewhat improved, or maybe the windows might even be opened.
Francis Anderton covers design and architecture for KCRW. Francis, as always, thanks.
You're very welcome, Steve.
So what about you? Will you ever look at air conditioning the same? Are you afraid of turning yours on? Or when you're at the office or grocery store or some building, are you concerned about all that recirculated air? Tell us what you think. KCRW.com/AskGreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, nearly 50 years to the day since tens of thousands gathered in L.A. for the Chicano Moratorium, a march that decried disproportionate Latino deaths in the Vietnam War, but it was about so much more. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In the meantime, thanks for your ears and for your time today. Make it a great day.